I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of April 17th, 2015.
I feel the need for speed.
Ow! Ow! Me too. This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times. Lizzie O'Leary brings back that love and feeling when she returns next week. This week, we're talking about speed, the warp speed of financial markets, the speed of bargains, and the dancing speed of your heart. You'll find out what that means in a little bit. Where does your money go in a hurry? Mine never hesitates to buy toys or my dog. Let us know how you spend your flash cash at marketplaceweekend.org. There was a time when the only trolls you'd encounter would be under bridges, harassing Billy Goat's Gruff. These days, they're everywhere, and they can wreck your reputation in a big hurry. Trolls are coming after anyone with the temerity to express an opinion online, and believe me, that's something I know about. To tell us more about this not very pleasant aspect of life in the digital age and what we can do about it, we're joined by John Ronson. He's the author of the new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Hiya, John.
Hey, nice to speak to you.
Likewise, I'm sure. Now, to illustrate what's going on in your book, which is fascinating, let's take a look at what happened to the South African comedian Trevor Noah, who is the incoming host of The Daily Show.
Right. So he, in the morning, it was announced that he was going to be taken over from Jon Stewart, and everybody was hailing him and hailing the choice and, you know, what an interesting guy. And then I think a journalist from BuzzFeed went through his 9,000 tweets and found five crappy ones, dating back, you know, 5 years, if I'm right. And so he went in the space of like an hour from like interesting choice to horrendous villain. It was as if, like, we on social media had all decided that we could use these five decontextualized and, you know, crappy jokes as clues to this man's, like, inherent true wicked self. And his career could have been over because of that.
What's your advice for him?
Well, actually, something really interesting happened with Trevor Noah, because usually if an employee is publicly shamed, it happened with Justine Sacco and pretty much everybody else in my book, they're immediately fired. But with Trevor Noah, it was kind of different in a really interesting way. Comedy Central said, you can't define somebody by a couple of jokes that landed badly. And Trevor Noah said the same thing, and I think Jon Stewart said the same thing. And that was so courageous of them to do that, because it's so easy to just throw the transgressive employee away and save your skin. So I thought it was kind of wonderful that Comedy Central and The Daily Show acted the way they did.
And the speed with which that happened is really the whole story here, because there was a time when getting your scarlet letter was a fairly laborious process.
I mean, there's some people in my book who were destroyed while they were asleep on a plane. They made a joke that landed badly, and then while they slept, they were destroyed. So it's terrible.
You're talking about Justine Sacco here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she was destroyed because of a joke that landed badly while she slept. And in fact, the fact that she was asleep and unable to be part of her destruction was part of the hilarity of people. Also, you know, there's another guy in my book, Jonah Lehrer, whose transgression was worse. It wasn't jokes that landed badly. It was proper journalistic sins. But when he tried to...
He's the guy who made up the Bob Dylan quotes.
That's right. And when he tried to apologise at a Knight Foundation lunch, a journalist foundation lunch. It was live streamed, and they erected a giant Twitter feed on a big screen next to his head, so anybody watching from home could tweet their ongoing opinion of Jonah's request for forgiveness in real time while he tried to apologize. And so as he was trying to apologize, he could see, like, cascading into his eyeline tweets like, Jonah Lehrer trying to bore us into forgiving him. Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath. He is tainted as a writer forever. Imagine if this was an actual court and, you know, the murderer stood up in court and was given a minute to explain themselves, and the jury were all yelling out, bored, sociopath. But that's the system we've created for ourselves.
Well, but what's really happening, right? Have we always been horrible, vicious people, but we've been held back by technology? Or has social media, in essence, given free rein to our inner horrible people and brought out the worst in us?
Well, you say horrible people, and also earlier on you talked about trolls, and I think there's something different going on. I mean, there are trolls out there, like terrible, misogynistic idiots, but that's not the people who were tearing apart Trevor Noah or Justine Sacco or Jonah Lehrer. It was good people trying to do good. It was nice people like us wanting to show that we're proper and ethical and empathetic, and we're attacking, we're punching up, we're attacking people misusing their privilege. So it's good people like us who are creating the most destruction.
What can one do? In the book, you pay a visit to the so-called reputation repair business, and you look at how they try and wage war online on your behalf. Is that the extent of it? I mean, can all you do is basically fight back using the tools that were part of your downfall?
Well, there are really smart companies that can bury the transgression underneath, you know, a kind of canopy of positive blogs about you. But unfortunately, that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you haven't got hundreds of thousands of dollars, you're on your own. When you're in the eye of a shaming, all you can do if you want to survive is just shut up, just shut the hell up, because everything you say at that moment will just be more evidence for the prosecution. So just shut up. We've created this system for ourselves, this kind of weird surveillance system, where the only way to survive is to either be bland or silent.
John Ronson is the author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we posted John's interview on our website, and many of you joined the discussion. On Facebook, Charlene Miyashta wrote, "The correction should come from parents and other authority figures in that person's life, not from the general public, as those people do not know the entire circumstance." But Mark Hammontree pointed out, "When one person does something shameful, their behavior needs correction." What do you think? Do you avoid criticizing others online? Do you subtweet? Do you think all this public shaming has gone too far, or is it deserved? Join the discussion. Visit marketplaceweekend.org and click on Go. Check out the conversation on Facebook, or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're talking speed on this week's show. In the stock market, things can change really fast, and it seems like volatility is growing. It's like riding a fiscal roller coaster. The view might be fine from the top, but suddenly... Marketplace's resident explainer, Patty Hirsch, and I are both sitting here with our hands in the air as we take that last drop, and he joins us now to talk about smart market strategies when everything's so darn quick. Hiya, Patty.
Hello, David.
The market. I mean, it just seems like it is more volatile than ever these days.
Up and down like a yo-yo, no doubt.
So, Patty, should I be hanging on for dear life? Is the stock market about to just scare the bejeepers out of us?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people this week have started to beat this drum of pessimism. A lot of banks are saying that we could see a correction in the market now. We could see the market fall as much as 10% in the next 6 months.
Why? Why would it go down that much when we've been seeing up and down for so long now?
Well, specifically because it's been tracking up for so long and the economy is still struggling. You know, the economy is not doing that well. We saw this week that retail sales were not that great. They were up a bit, but strip out auto sales and they pretty much flatlined. We're starting to see industrial production has been down. The economy doesn't look that great, but yet the stock market is doing really, really well. And the stock market is a bet on how companies are going to perform in the future. Like, if you buy a company's stock today, you're hoping that it's going to be worth a lot more in 6 months or whenever you're going to sell it for more money. But it's only going to be worth more if it's making more money from selling more stuff. And it's only going to sell more stuff if people are going to buy that stuff, which means the economy has to improve. It's got to be in better shape. It's, you know, consumers have got to be more confident. They've got to be out there spending. And that's not the way the economy looks right now.
But if we're betting on future growth and future prosperity, why isn't everybody out buying even more stocks?
Well, they are. I mean, that's the point, is that you're seeing the stock market tracking upwards. But a lot of people are looking at that saying, that looks like it's way too high right now. People are still buying it because, frankly, there's very few other places to get decent yield, get decent return on your investment. And a lot of economists are looking at the economy bubbling along down the bottom, not really doing that well, and looking at the scorching performance of the stock market and saying, I just don't see the stock market doing that well in 6 months. I think it needs to correct. It needs to come down a little bit in order to reflect the reality of what the economy is going to be like in 6 months to a year.
Even though we're seeing jobs numbers steadily rising, even though other signals like retail sales, productivity, they're all up.
It's true. You know, you're seeing wages higher. You're seeing more people employed. You're hearing about this gas dividend that people are getting because they're spending less money at the pump. But the fact is that they're not spending that money in the economy. And remember, our economy is dependent on consumer spending. Consumer spending takes up 2/3 of the economy. There seems to be this outbreak of I don't know, fiscal responsibility amongst the American public. People are actually paying down debt. People are actually saving that money. What they're not doing is spending it, and that is holding the economy down.
Okay, now you're spooking the herd. So should everybody be thinking about taking their money out of the market because Patty said that we're kind of overdoing it?
No. Remember, most people who are listening to this show are not institutional investors, right? We're investors who invest for the long term for our retirement. We're in this for 30, 40 years. We shouldn't be focusing on the ups and downs for the next, you know, 3 days or 6 months or even a year. We're in it for the long term. We're interested in that long, smooth, upward trajectory that you get when you're in the market for 30 years or more.
But some people might not have such a long time frame. For example, when we went into the recession, my kid's 529 college plan got hammered. And the clock's ticking there because he doesn't have that long frame. He's going to hit college age, and that 529 plan is either going to be there for him or not. What do you do in a situation like that?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. If you're investing over a very short term and, you know, it's, let's say, over a 10-year period and you do have something like, you know, the Great Recession, you know, knocks your investments out of the park, well, you're really unlucky. But to suggest that you, David, should be sitting in front of a computer screen crunching numbers and trying to time the market, I would never give you that advice because, you know, you'd probably make an even worse decision than just putting your money in the market and watching it correct in that way.
So getting back to our roller coaster thing, then it sounds like I should just hang on for dear life and maybe take a Dramamine.
You can take any drug you want, David, so long as it stops you from freaking out day to day.
Patty Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus. Every day, our By the Numbers blog gives you the numbers worth watching. Here are Marketplace digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with a look at some of the fast facts we've been watching this week.
$152.8 billion
is how much taxpayers spent on public assistance programs for low-wage workers between 2009 and 2011.
That's according to a study out of UC Berkeley.
$10 billion.
Netflix says that's how many hours of content their users streamed in the first quarter of this year.
I know this because my roommate streams Friends every single night.
700,000.
That's how many followers.
And counting.
Barbie.
Yes, the doll.
Has on Instagram. It takes three people to meticulously style her account. Fashion website Racked has the origin story of what it's like to photograph a Barbie girl living in a Barbie world.
Thanks, guys. And for more of the day's and the week's most important stats, visit our By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org. We've been talking about speed and volatility in the stock market. And when it comes to fast action finances, you can't get much faster than the high-frequency trades that now set the pace in the stock market. To try and catch up with the light-speed world of high-frequency trading and how it impacts you, we're joined by Molly Wood. She's Marketplace's new fill-in host, feature correspondent, and all-around renaissance woman. Okay, right off the bat, Molly, how fast are these trades?
We are talking, as you mentioned, very close to the speed of light. And apparently recently, when there were rumors that physicists may have found a way to exceed the speed of light, the people who got the most excited were high-frequency traders who thought if there were a way for us to trade at faster than light speeds, now that would be the money. They measure time in chunks of milliseconds, and they measure lengths of network cables to make sure that they're not losing any milliseconds in the transactions that they're conducting. And so when we talk about high frequency, we're talking about the kind of frequency that only computers can accomplish.
And for everyone playing along at home, a millisecond is 1/1000th of a second.
Exactly.
It's a little
itty bitty.
And there's an 8-millisecond delay, I think, for every maybe 100 feet. That is the extent to which they are out there with the tape measures, because they're trying to avoid delays of up to 8 milliseconds. That can cost quite a lot of money.
So obviously, no human hands are touching a trade like this. This is being done exclusively by computers.
It is being done exclusively by computers, and that is the interesting part. The computers are essentially trained to recognize trends as they arrive, to respond to breaking news in the market, and to anticipate trades and execute them at these unbelievably high speeds.
So what does that do to the marketplace? Obviously, everything's moving a lot faster.
On the one hand, it's a benefit because the market can respond really quickly, and you can essentially be working in real time as news is unfolding, as deals are unfolding, mergers and acquisitions. The market is responding like a heartbeat.
Real time is me watching CNBC, seeing something going on, and then going on to the Schwab site or the Vanguard site and making a trade.
Forget it.
Not a happening thing.
Nope.
Anymore.
Not a happening thing. And at that point, you are already out. You are already out of the movement, out of the heartbeat. You're out of the breath.
So there's no room whatsoever for an individual investor here.
Well, that was the concern, right? The concern when high-frequency trading really became public, when people really started to understand what it was that the market was rigged against the individual investor, that there was no way for you to ever, because like you said, once you go on Schwab and you think, oh, well, this tungsten deal sounds kind of great. I think I'm going to invest in aluminum for the way. Forget it, right? That the market has already responded. Now there's a sense that for most individual investors, I mean, for one thing, only a little more than half of the American public is invested in the stock market at all, has holdings. And most of those holdings exist in a retirement plan. So they're not changing very often. You're not trading very often. So it is mostly somebody like a day trader, again, a very small number of people, and big funds who are affected by this. And then they're affected in relatively small percentages. It might just be a few pennies here and there. So in terms of the individual investor, and even in terms of the big investor, the amounts of money that might be being lost in these transactions are not gigantic. And most individual investors won't be affected.
But presumably, to remain a player, my pension plan or my 401k has to be able to play in this new arena and thus compete at this super fast speed.
Absolutely.
And so they're doing this on my behalf?
So they're doing this on your behalf. The computers are operating on your behalf without you even seeing it. Now, where this becomes a concern, of course, is if the computers make a mistake.
Well, do they make mistakes?
They have made pretty big mistakes. There's such a thing that they have become known as flash crashes. A flash crash is something that occurs when a computer makes a mistake. Maybe it misreports a number. Maybe it somehow reports on a news event that didn't happen. And the market essentially starts trading at light speed on that news, but erroneously. And that can cause billions of dollars to be lost in just a few minutes.
Like a few years ago when I remember the Dow tanked like 600 points or something within a matter of moments and everyone just held their breath.
Right. That's a flash crash. And you kind of can't stop it once it's happening, because it's happening at light speed. It's happening so quickly that billions of dollars can be lost in a matter of moments. And the market sort of has to then slowly recover and climb back up. That's probably the biggest concern of all. I know Mark Cuban is really mad about high-frequency trading, and he does believe, and others do believe, that that means it's essentially rigged against the individual investor. I think we could say it's probably rigged against the individual investor in so many other ways that high-frequency trading is only one.
But how do you regulate a market like this? I mean, is the SEC getting into their Starship Enterprise and traveling at warp 10 to keep up?
The SEC is interested and obviously concerned because the flash crashes have had such a big impact in terms of real dollars. But most people involved with the market say that they would prefer the speed, because the speed generates efficiency and you can respond quickly and there's a lot of money to be made. The general feeling of the market and the traders seems to be that they would prefer making the money versus being overregulated.
So this isn't going away. This is now the status quo.
This is absolutely the status quo. I would be very surprised if you saw any serious regulation around high-frequency trading, because honestly, the people who are doing the trading, even if they lose a little money here and there, would still rather have the opportunity to benefit from computers doing all this hard work.
All right. I got to catch my breath. Molly Wood, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Here's a question for you. How fast is fast when you're at the drive-thru window of your favorite fast food place?
I'd say...
5 minutes.
5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Nope.
10 minutes?
No, 7 minutes.
7 seconds.
6 minutes?
Uh-uh.
About 300 seconds?
Well, what is it like?
4 minutes, maybe.
3 to 4 minutes.
3 minutes.
I think about 3 minutes.
90 seconds.
Maybe like 2 minutes then.
Close. The answer is 203.29 seconds, and that's just under 4 minutes. Turns out the pace of fast food has actually been getting slower as menus have grown more complex, and now the industry wants to both simplify and kick things into a higher gear. To tell us more about that, we're joined by Sam Okus. He's the editor of QSR Magazine. That's the Bible of the fast food industry.
What we're seeing is that in the last 5 or so years, this pressure for better, more premium, and healthier menu items is applying a little bit more pressure on the fast food operations. So now when you have these more ingredients that you have to put into menu items, whether that's healthier ingredients or just more flavorful, bold ingredients, which is what customers are demanding these days, it takes a little bit more time to do that. So now you even see something like Taco Bell has some menu items that have 10, 11, 12 ingredients, whereas, you know, it didn't used to be the case. So in order to be able to put together these menu items accurately, it takes a little bit more time.
Now, according to the survey done by your magazine, the wait time at the drive-thru on average has increased by about 20 seconds. And for busy people like me, that's an eternity.
Yeah. So the demand from the customer has not changed. So even though fast food drive-thrus, generally speaking, are getting slower, customers actually still demand the experience to be faster.
And yet I did a little looking around at McDonald's and Taco Bell and Burger King, and they all seem to have programs designed to speed the experience up. They seem to feel that 20 seconds is a life or death struggle for them.
The restaurants recognize that the customers want something higher quality, and they recognize that they want to take a little bit more time to be able to offer those higher quality items. But that doesn't mean that they're going to just rest on their laurels and say, oh, okay, well, it's going to be slower then. They absolutely want us to still go as fast as possible, because when you consider, again, just the volume of traffic going through the drive-thru, fast food restaurants generally do anywhere between 60 and 70% of their business in the drive-thru. So it still behooves them to be able to go as quickly as possible and get those cars through the lane.
And what else are they doing? For example, it looks like McDonald's is trying to take things off of the menu to eliminate the choices that customers have.
That's right. There are a variety of things that fast food restaurants are trying to do in order to make this a little bit more of a streamlined process. So one thought is to have a more limited menu in the drive-thru lane. So customers might still be able to, if they know that, you know, a Big Mac is still on the menu, even though it's not on the menu board outside, you know, they could still order it. But by offering fewer choices on the menu board outside, it gives the customers who either don't know the menu as well or who are they just want to get a quick meal, you know, gives them sort of a more less options to be able to look over, because it saves time in terms of them not just sitting there and looking over what they want to order. So that's one method. You know, another thing that's going to be really huge in the future, really not even in the future, but just even soon probably, is mobile, whether that's some sort of radio ping or something lets the restaurant know that the customer is there to pick up their order. And I think that's going to really be one of the biggest strategies moving into the future with the fast food drive-thru.
Is there any sort of speed benchmark that the industry aspires to? For example, if the average wait at the drive-thru is now 203.29 seconds, what is looked at as the holy grail here? 150 seconds? 1 minute? What are they looking for?
Well, I can tell you that in the history of our study, so we've done our drive-thru study for about 17 years now. In the history of the study, the all-time high is 116 seconds from Wendy's. I believe that was back in 2004, 2005, sometime around then. That's just impressive. That's really good. 116 seconds is it will probably never get better than that. And even Wendy's itself, Wendy's is historically almost year after year the fastest drive-through in the industry, according to our research. And even Wendy's probably won't top that. Wendy's is more down to, you know, 130, 140 something. But generally speaking, you know, something under 200 seconds is, I think, generally something that a lot of these companies would probably strive for.
What's my weight at Chick-fil-A?
At Chick-fil-A, the last time we studied them, they were somewhere around between 180, 190 seconds, I believe.
I don't know. 3 whole minutes, it's an outrage. Not when Wendy's right there offering me 2 minutes. Sam Okus is the editor of QSR Magazine. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Susan is an alternative hip-hop producer and DJ. Maybe you know him by his nom de club, The Gaslamp Killer. Speed is particularly important to Will, and if you attend one of his gigs, you might notice that the beats of the music are frequently in sync with the beat of your heart. Coincidence? Uh-uh. Will explains.
I come in so quiet and so weird that you don't even know it's starting yet, and then I build up from 60 BPM... to 100 BPM, to 120 if I'm feeling really frisky. But a lot of people won't follow you all the way there. A healthy human heart beats between 60 and 120 beats per minute. So it's kind of ironic that all of the music in the world, besides car alarm sounding techno and dance music that sound like some kind of fire alarm going off in the building, which is higher BPMs, everything else, the best music, in my opinion, in the world, is going from 60 to 120 BPMs. I sort my experience using the BPM, and I like to stop whatever party was happening before I showed up. I like to stop that party, and I like to start my own. Something slow around the 60 BPM range to kind of reset everyone. And then we slowly move up to 70, up to 75, up to 80, up to 85, up to 90, 90 to 100, even higher. The beats, the rhythms, not the rappers and the singers and the bands per se, more of the focused beats. That's what it is, the beat scene, you know? And the drums drive those beats. That's where the beats got their popularity. Sometimes if I don't feel them coming back, then I'll change my mind and I'll drop a sound sample from tons of classic movie moments that really bring people back together when they don't know where they've gone. All of a sudden, I'll play this moment from Ferris Bueller's Day Off where he's quoting, "Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to look around once in a while,
if you don't stop and look around once in a while,
you could miss it." And like just dropping that, it gave me goosebumps right now just describing what it does to the people. I'm trying to keep the rhythm flowing. When people are connected with what I'm doing, it's like church for me, you know? Everybody gets in sync with my rhythm. I've made quite a few songs. Some of those songs that I've made, written and produced on my own, have been picked up by Grand Theft Auto 5. A few other places have licensed my music, and I think a lot of DJs are pursuing that now because they're realizing that people get music for free. So you gotta find another way to make money in this business. Out of the blue, Apple Computers called me and said, "Hey man, do you have time for a chat?" I said, "Is this a hoax? Is this a prank? We would like you to be in our commercial to show off what the iPad can do." And I thought it was a joke, but that happened a few months ago. Hope should always stick with you because things do come of it. You know, it's not just that logical adult naysayer in your brain you should be listening to, because the child mind is right a lot.
Will's new album, The Gaslamp Killer Experience, comes out April 28th. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus, in for Lizzie, who will be back next week. We're talking speed, and let's start this segment off with a flash, as in flash sales. When's the last time you paid top dollar for anything? In this age of social media and online promotions, the rule of thumb seems to be if you paid the full retail price, you were had. Whether it's a coupon arriving in your inbox, a Groupon offer, or a tweet alerting you to a quickie deal, this is the era of instant retail gratification. Flash sales, in industry parlance. So how do you keep up? What's the best way to take advantage of this super fast way of doing business? And do flash sales make sense for merchants who seem to be focusing on individual deals rather than long-term relationships? Valerie Folks, a professor at USC's Marshall School of Business, joins us to explain.
Some sale will be offered on the internet, and typically it will be mentioned through social media. One reason why it's so successful is it generates a lot of talk, a lot of chatter on the web.
Now, let me give you a for instance. I have bought wristwatches online before, so the internet knows I like watches. Therefore, I see lots of ads for watches. Earlier today, I got a tweet, a suggested tweet or a sponsored tweet or whatever they're calling paid ads. I got one of those that said, act fast, watches are going for two for $60. Now, I assume that's a flash sale right there.
Yes, that would be a flash sale. Now, think about how that works as opposed to the fact when you're just sitting around thinking about various kinds of watches you might buy. Well, you could always procrastinate on that purchase. There's no time pressure. So the great thing about a flash sale, from the perspective of the seller anyway, is that it gets you going. It generates some momentum. You now have to make a decision fast. And oftentimes when people make very fast decisions, they don't weigh things quite so carefully. They tend to jump for it.
Hence, this is a digital version of the impulse buy, which is the thing that you're going to buy right there at the cash register.
Exactly, yes. Very effective, too.
Can you give us an example of specific companies that do better at flash sales than others?
Well, let's take travel. Everyone likes to travel, and people like to daydream about traveling, but oftentimes people will procrastinate about actually staking that step and checking for fares and booking a particular flight. Well, a flash sale for an airline is very effective because then people have to decide, okay, I really need to do this thing that I've been fantasizing about. I need to do it right now.
I seem to recall JetBlue during the darkest days of winter offered people on the East Coast a $32 fare for 32 minutes, as long as the weather was 32 degrees out.
Yes, wasn't that a clever way to market their product? It fits so well with JetBlue because, first of all, it's kind of a fun idea. Second of all, it gets people thinking about JetBlue because it reminds people JetBlue offers all these great deals. I really need to pay attention to JetBlue because who knows what they'll come up with next.
But how do they not lose money with something like that?
What they're really doing here is buying great publicity. Because they're getting people talking about their airline and about travel. And look, if you miss out on this, if you don't actually get on the airplane, you are now thinking about going someplace. And you're thinking about going someplace that JetBlue flies.
So this is the cyber equivalent of a loss leader or a doorbuster.
Yes, yes. Or buying publicity, right.
In fact, rather than, let's say, traditional marketing, like buying a newspaper ad or buying a banner ad online, this is a way of putting your marketing dollars to perhaps a more playful use.
That's right. And one of the problems many companies have, is trying to figure out how to market to this generation that is so much more wired than previous generations. What we find is that a lot of young people don't spend as much time on traditional media. And so how do we reach those people? Well, this JetBlue ad or promotion is just the sort of thing that works very effectively on the web.
So in the case of Groupon, you have these very low offers. You have very specific time limits that are involved. How does that affect the dynamic of flash sales?
So Groupon is a very interesting type of promotional device because it requires people to sign up to get access to those. And that helps because then only certain people hear about the promotions. Now, Groupon seemed like a really good deal for a while, but I think the more recent research suggests that it works for this price-sensitive group of consumers, but it doesn't really generate long-term sales. So Groupon people tend to go only for the sales. This still can help a company, though, or a retailer. Let's suppose a retailer offers an opportunity for Groupon people to try his or her product, whether it's a nail salon, hair salon, or restaurant, or whatever. It does generate traffic, and sometimes that's important. Just the perception of seeing a place that seems to be crowded, seems to be well patronized, encourages other people then to also go to that retail outlet.
Yeah, but you're saying, yeah, there'll be a first date, but you won't necessarily get a relationship out of it.
Yes, that's right.
Well, let's go back to that tweet I saw earlier about getting two watches for $60. If you get enough of those kind of offers, or 40% off for a pair of shoes, or whatever it is, aren't you going to become inured to this sort of thing, and you simply will never, ever pay full price again? You'll just always wait around for the special deal, and thus the merchant is in a situation where he or she is constantly having to offer sale prices.
Oh, David, you're so right. This does happen all the time. And what people have learned for certain department stores and a lot of retail outlets is not to buy. It is a dilemma because timing of promotions has to be very good and very thoughtful if a company wants to not train people to just wait for a sale to buy.
Valerie Folks is a professor of marketing at USC Marshall School of Business. Valerie, thank you very much for this flashy interview.
Thank you, David.
So let's put what we just learned into action. If you want to travel, you already know that you're going to be paying a pretty penny, especially for airline tickets. That said, it seems like we're always hearing about people who somehow got a sweet deal on tickets. How did they do it? Is there some way to game the system? Well, turns out there is, sort of. And to tell us more, we're joined by George Hobica. He's head of AirfareWatchdog.com. Hiya, George.
Hi, David.
So I see a tweet, I see a Facebook posting, I see an email saying Southwest Airlines or United Airlines or American Airlines, low, low, low fares. Clock's ticking. How fast do I have to move on that?
Well, it really depends, David. I think there are three types of these sale fares. One is the advertised sale, which you get in your email from Southwest Airlines. The other is unadvertised sales. And these are the ones that the airlines don't really want you to know about because they only have a few seats available at the lowest fare. The third kind is the mistake fare.
Well, and the mistake fare. I remember United Airlines recently, they had mistake transatlantic fares for very low prices and didn't honor them.
Yes. You know, so many years ago, the airlines had in their contract of carriage, if we make a mistake, we don't have to honor them. And then the DOT said, yes, you do have to honor them. In the case of the latest United mistake fare, it wasn't United that made the mistake. It was a third-party site that was doing a currency conversion inaccurately, and United was able, I think legitimately, to wiggle out of it. A lot of times when these mistake fares happen, it goes all over the internet, and people pile on. And when I mean pile on, they buy 20 first-class tickets for $2, and it really does cause some loss to the airline.
You refer to what's basically a stealth sale. An airline has a few seats left over on a specific flight, wants to get the word out fast. So what do they do?
Well, usually they don't do anything. They lower the fare, and then airfare sites like Airfare Watchdog will send out an email or a tweet to tell people about these amazing sales.
So that's what your site specializes in. You see the fare go down, and you alert your customer base.
We alert our customers when there's a really, really cheap fare. And we also occasionally do these mistake fares. But personally, I feel a little bad about it. So I'm a little bit less likely to jump on a mistake airfare. The mistake fares, they have many, many seats available because there's no break on those fares. But the unadvertised sale fares, they might only have one or two seats at the lowest fare.
And you're alerting millions.
Yeah, so you really have to jump on it very, very quickly. And what I tell people is put it on a 24-hour hold because now the DOT has ruled that every airline requires that passengers be able to put fares on a hold. On American Airlines, you don't even have to pay for it. And then talk to your spouses and your friends and get the hotels and get all your ducks in line.
But how do I do that so fast? I mean, you're describing a game of musical chairs where the music stops and a million people try and sit in the chair.
You have to look at your tweets constantly. You have to check your emails constantly. And most of these fares, actually, people miss. But if you're on it, you can save literally hundreds of dollars. So, I mean, we saw recently, for example, Rio de Janeiro from several hub cities for $380 round trip on American Airlines.
So you watch airline flash sales for a living. What is the most amazing deal you ever saw?
We did see 77 cents on U.S. Airways from, say, Hilton Head to San Francisco round trip. We saw $20 first class from most U.S. cities to Honolulu round trip. Not too long ago, we saw this really weird deal. You had to fly from the United States to Prague and then from there to Hong Kong or Tokyo. And I think it was about $200, but it was one way. Then you had to find your way back. And a lot of people used airline miles to get back.
So before your site can send out the word that there's a deal out there, you have to find out about it. How do you do that?
We use the same tools that everyone else uses. We'll use Google Flights. We'll use Kayak. We'll use the airline sites, you know, the JetBlue.coms and the United.coms. And we see if we can book tickets. And if we can book tickets, we post them or tweet them. If we can't, then we know it's really not bookable.
Why can't I just do that?
Anyone can do it. Absolutely. You don't really need us, but we hope that we provide a service.
But if I've got a million people to beat, don't I want to be the one doing it just like you're doing it?
You know, one of the problems with a site like ours is that people don't like to share it. And because it might be only a few seats, yeah, you're definitely in competition with everyone else on the internet for those few seats that might be available. But we do hope that you share because friends don't let friends pay too much for airfare.
George Hobica is the head of AirfareWatchdog.com. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend, and every day you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to Tech in Real Life. Hiya, Ben.
Hey, David.
Let's talk about the need for speed.
The need for speed.
I feel the need for speed.
I have the need. Okay,
everyone playing along at home, that's Top Gun. Thank you very much. All right, and we're talking about the internet also, aside from, you know, fast jet fighters. And it gets faster and faster with every passing year, it seems. Anyone who's got cable broadband knows exactly what I'm talking about. So how much faster can it go is really the first question.
Well, it sort of depends on where you are, who your provider is, and what kind of service that they're offering you. But let's go back in time a little bit, David, to the ARPANET, the predecessor to the internet. Now, that started with speeds of 50 kilobits per second. That is, of course, insanely slow by today's standards. Broadband has come a long way since then, as you probably know, and we can now quickly sort of stream music, stream movies, or download music and movies. You could download the Marketplace Tech or the Marketplace Weekend podcast, for instance, and listen to that.
Way to plug, dude.
Yeah, so a lot of faster things have come along. Big telecom companies have upped their speeds. They're offering speeds of 100 megabits or up to 300 megabits per second, which is a lot faster, obviously. You also hear a lot of talk about fiber optic cable and fiber networks that offer much faster speeds than a lot of people have now. Fiber optic cable is made from silica glass. Light travels through it. You remember, I'm sure, David, from your science classes that light travels at around 300 million miles per hour. In optical fibers, it travels about 31% slower than that, apparently. So you've heard of Google Fiber, have you, David?
Yes. In fact, it's in a handful of markets and gradually spreading throughout the whole country.
Gradually spreading throughout the whole country. I actually went to Kansas City recently where they have Google Fiber, and I heard a guy say that he loves it so much that he watches people upload and download giant files, and that is actually interesting to him. Comcast is offering a similar service, 2 gigabits per second in some markets. AT&T is also offering a similar service, although for AT&T, you'll actually probably spend about $40 more per month than Google Fiber. So we're at the beginning of this. There's a wide range in price, and that's probably about a lack of real competition when it comes to fiber networks.
Now, you make it sound like we're out in front of all this, but when you look at the international rankings, the U.S. comes at something like 14th or 15th.
Not the top of the class.
We're talking about broadband speeds, South Korea is number one, and I saw that they were going to bring something like a 10 gig speed online within, you know, weeks, if not months. So we're sort of dragging our heels, and it doesn't sound like we're having as much fun on the Autobahn when it comes to the info superhighway.
They're also building a time machine, I think, so we'll have to see if that actually plays out. No, I'm just kidding. Municipalities are actually experimenting more and more with building fiber networks to, again, spur competition in some ways and spur the laying of this cable, and that can be an expensive and intense process. The U.S. is obviously not there yet, David.
Interestingly, we've all seen the universal service fee on our phone bills, and in the past, that was for getting phone service to everywhere, and now the FCC is allocating that money for broadband, which is good, but can the government take a leadership role in actually not just expanding broadband, but speeding it up as well?
Well, it depends on who you ask. The organizations that control the internet are a mix of government, big telecom companies, and smaller innovators who actually want to disrupt the marketplace for this sort of thing. Right now, it's mostly the first two. It's mostly government and big telecom. You know about the FCC doing some of these things and their new open internet rules that, barring a successful legal challenge, will give the agency the ability to regulate speed. Big companies don't like this idea because they would like to have the most control and come up with innovative ways to charge the consumer for it. Now, I don't know if you and I necessarily would love that as the end user, but it's not always necessarily a bad thing because it helps them compete, and robust competition is generally good, at least in our world. Oversight, though, is also important, David, and that's why you have the FCC taking a role here. And the good news is that for now, the future is so bright we have to wear shades, at least when it comes to a future where the U.S. might have more competition in internet service providers and thus higher speeds.
Could we have worked more pop culture references into this conversation?
We can try.
Well, this segment sped by much too fast. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and Ben, you can be my wingman anytime.
David, thank you.
That's our show. I'm going to go buzz the tower. Lizzie's back next week, shedding some light on the invisible aspects of our economy. My thanks to her for letting me play with her toys these past few weeks. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ahmed and Eliza Mills. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. As always, make sure to check with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.